So it's my pleasure to introduce Jesse Liu, who you all know already. He got his PhD in Oxford. Before he tells me, he was a PSI student here, and now he's at the University of Cambridge. So if you...
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me. It is really great to be back. This is actually how it started, as you see, back in 2014. That was when I first arrived here. Here's me with Natalia and one of my compatriot PSI students, Mariana. And back in those days, I was working on much more theoretical topics, continuous spin particles. So that was good fun. But since I have moved on to other things, I do much more experimental things here. So from the Morfino stuff, very classic electroweak physics, looking for dark matter, Higgsinos and Sleptons in ATLAS. So I'm a member of ATLAS now. I also do lots of hardware. You can see me in the lab actually poking things at hardware, including the axion stuff. But today, I think I'm going to focus on the photon collision stuff, because I think that's something that I have been finding very interesting in recent years. So last April, I was a postdoc at Chicago, and just down the road, people were very excited around the world about this new result, which may or may not be interesting new physics. Of course, the lattice calculations is somewhere in the middle here, which is yet to be resolved. And today, I am going to be asking about the tau g minus 2, because I think it's something that we don't really hear as much about, but is something that I was working with one of the Oxford postdocs. And she and I were thinking, well, why don't people talk about the tau as much? You know, there are three charged leptons after all, right? And every time you go to a muon g minus 2 seminar, it's always like the third generation does not even exist in their talks. And I just want to be... very, very happy to say that the ATLAS collaboration has actually realized our idea. In fact, just last week, the ATLAS collaboration that I've been working with has put their result on the archive. So it has come full circle, the theorist's dream. Right? You propose your idea, and you can actually do it inside ATLAS. So I'm going to focus on the colliding light part first, just because it's something that we don't hear as much about when we think about LHC physics. But just to take a step back, right, you know, light has historically transformed science because we have had many different revolutions in understanding light in terms of ray optics, right, which is an effective theory of light before we knew that it was waves from Maxwell's equations. And of course, people didn't really know what light was back then, right? But this theory allowed them to build telescopes and microscopes that I think really opened up new areas of science, right? Modern astronomy and cell biology, people like Galileo and Hooke. Then there's also wave optics, right? Once we discovered that Maxwell's equations gives you these EM waves, and we discovered new effects, right? Diffraction and interferometry, which of course paved the empirical foundations for quantum theory and relativity. So I think this cadence of, you know, understanding light better, building new instruments, leads to new discoveries. So that's all very nice. And of course, in the past decade, we've seen, you know, precisely controlling light still continues to transform science, right? Me as the LHC physicist, of course, remembers the Higgs boson discovery some 10 years ago. But even in recent years, you know, interferometry is still how we discovered gravitational waves, as well as things like Doppler shift and adaptive optics being really central for these more astrophysical exoplanet and the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. Now, as a collider physicist, you know, when I think about light, of course, I ask, well, what happens if we collide light at the most extreme laboratory energies? And, you know, just to go back to basics, QED, right, when Dirac wrote down his famous equation, matter can annihilate into antimatter to convert into light. This, of course, now has the famous application in medical imaging through PET. But, of course, quantum mechanics teaches us the inverse can also happen. Two photons can meet and actually turn back into matter and antimatter, right? So this is something that, you know, we can do in the lab, but also in astrophysics, right, photons like gamma rays can hit a CMB photon and actually be absorbed, right? That induces the opacity in cosmology. And then the other thing that quantum mechanics teaches us is that before the particles become on shell, they can actually re-annihilate back into photons. And this induces this one loop self-interaction of photons which otherwise would not have an interaction because Maxwell's equations are linear, right? So two photons in Maxwell's equation just pass straight through each other without interaction. But here they can actually scatter off each other. And the reason why I think there's been a lot of interest in the LHC community is because of some recent experimental breakthroughs, which I will just show you now. So the first breakthrough is this observation of light-by-light scattering in ATLAS. This was observed back in 2019 by the ATLAS collaboration, a series of papers down here of the evidence, observation, and measurement. CMS has also presented the evidence as well. So what you're seeing here in the ATLAS detector are two photons, right? And basically nothing else in the detector. They're two back-to-back photons, these two green things here. And what's remarkable is that in this event display, it says that all charged particle tracks above 100 MeV are shown. So these are exquisitely quiet events. So what's going on, right? So usually when you think about heavy ion collisions at the LHC, two lead ions that we're showing here will collide, and lots of messy particles are created because it's the strong interaction at play. But what you were just seeing there, right, are these two lead ions passing by each other, and they don't interact via the strong force. But of course, these lead ions, they have all their electrons stripped. They have a huge electromagnetic field surrounding them, and these act as a cloud of nearly on-shell particles, photons, that can interact and collide to make new particles instead. So the history behind this is quite interesting. It goes back to the 1930s, when people were thinking about quantum mechanics in its very primitive form. But this is now known as the equivalent photon approximation, right? The fact that we can treat these EM fields, which are Lorentz contracted, right, as a coherent source of photons, which is quite interesting. And to make this a little bit more precise, right, you can actually have a plot here. Right? So this I just took from this reference down here. So this is in analogy with the PDFs, the particle distribution functions that describes your quark and gluon luminosities. You can actually describe this as a photon luminosity, right, as a function of the invariant mass. So this is the square root S hat you often see in PDFs, but this is for the invariant mass of the colliding photons. So what you see plotted here is the black line is the lead case, as well as the red line, which is the PP case, which is at 14 TeV. And you can see how to access the very high masses in the electroweak scale, we need to use protons instead. But what's very interesting is that, you know, that there are all sorts of thresholds, right? The difermions down at lower masses, but also interesting electroweak mass particles at the very highest masses. And they have various cross sections here. And what's interesting is the WW boson has a sizable cross section here. And of course, BSM physics, like axiom light particles, these resonances that couple to two photons, can of course arise at any of these masses.
So you talk about EPA for this, but if you have these massive final states, then the photon is not, to a good approximation, not real, right? So you have to go beyond this type of approximations. People, I'm assuming, do that.
So the approximation in which the EPA is valid is this, right? It's where the Q square, so the virtuality of the photon, is much less than the invariant mass of the two photons. And for most of the cases, it's actually significantly lower. So below about this GeV scale, so anything above this is when this condition is satisfied and you can use this.
I guess what you're going to talk about is that.
So the
approximation.
Yeah, so the condition, you know, this 0.1 GeV, yeah, it's much lower down here. It's an order of magnitude lower.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah. So if you're making, yeah, exactly. So in this regime, right, at the threshold of the taus, it's still very valid. Yes. Yeah, and there are papers which discuss this little fuzzy region down here where this approximation starts to break down. But yeah, for the purpose of this talk, we're safely in this regime. Okay, so of course, what continued to attract me to this area is that we can actually create two weak scale mass particles from the collision of two photons, which is quite remarkable when you think about it, but in PP collisions here, right? And of course, the difference with PP collisions is that there are multiple interactions per crossing, But of course, what you saw for that light-by-light case, where you only have two particles and basically nothing else, still applies at the hard interaction here, right? So the Ws can decay into electrons and muons, so the electron in yellow, the muon in red, and that you can see there's nothing else around it, that interaction, because the protons, they can stay intact, right? Just like the lead case. So there's no hadronic interactions there, but of course you have additional tracks nearby, because which is what we call pileup. And I think it's quite interesting that, you know, when I try to explain this to, you know, friends and family outside of physics, you know, the W boson is about the mass of a bromine molecule. That's quite interesting, right? You're turning massless particles into a bromine atom. So one of the claims that I just made is that these protons can remain intact, and that means they can travel down the beam pipe and they can actually be detected. So this is one of the other breakthroughs that I was heavily involved in for the past couple of years, which is to try to detect these protons that are flying down the beam pipe. So what you're seeing here is a dielectron event, right? So a much more primitive reaction here. And we installed detectors far down. So these are very, very close, but what you can do here, yes, because the protons, they've lost a little bit of energy, the LHC dipoles, the Lorentz force, will push them a little bit off where they would usually otherwise go around the ring. So they get deflected because the Lorentz force is reduced when the protons have lost a bit of energy, because the protons have emitted a hard photon. So you can insert these detectors, these 3D silicon pixels, within 2 millimeters from the main beam. So these are really close to the main beam. And it's a bit like how the LHCb detector, they actually insert it during stable beams and they retract it when the beams are unstable. So it's quite technologically interesting. And this was first done in 2017. It's called Atlas Forward Proton. And they live just over 200 meters away down the beam pipe. So when you hear people talk about Roman pots, right, these are those detectors down here. And the Roman pot, pot actually stands for protons on target. And it's developed by the Rome group, hence it was called Roman pots. So the quantity that we're interested in here is the fractional proton energy loss, right? And so these detectors, they act like a spectrometer. And a spectrometer, it's a bit like a prism, right? You can split white light into its colors. Right, so here, you actually have a spectrum of proton energies because some of them have lost a bit of energy as they emit photons to create new particles. So here, you're really just splitting the colors of the proton beam, and they get displaced more if they've lost more energy. So that's pretty cool, right? That you can use the LHC dipoles like a prism to split the protons into its colors.
This has, how good of a time resolution do you have?
That's a very good question. Yep. So what I just discussed was the tracking, yeah. Right? There are also these clear bars, which are for the timing. Oh, okay. And we've reached down to about 25 picosecond wow. time resolution, which is quite remarkable. So you can actually resolve the vertices to about millimeter resolution, right? And of course, the reason why you want to do that is because you want to pick out the correct PP vertex here, right? So these distances are of order millimeters. Yeah, so that is also quite a remarkable technology that we can have timing resolutions down to 20, yeah, which is quite remarkable. And it's something that, even when I had been working in the LHC for a while, I was like, wow, that's quite amazing. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So this is in the standard data PP data taking, high pile up. Yeah.
I mean, but this fractions,
yeah. Yeah. I was gonna ask the same. So people wanna measure proton forward cross sections with this, right? Because they don't know how to compute them. That's my
Oh yeah, so there is another set of detectors called Alpha. Which does exactly that, which is the total cross-section of PP interactions.
But how is that different from, why did you do that here? Is 2 millimeters enough that you already sufficiently far from the forward direction that you don't get the...
Yeah, so the detectors that measure the total PP cross-sections, they're slightly further down, and they run at low luminosities when the beams are much more defocused so that they can get their detectors much closer to the beam so that you can measure the elastic scattering cross section.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas here, you're actually creating particles at high invariant masses.
But won't you measure also lots of protons with small deflection?
Yeah, so we can't catch all of the protons, which lose a little bit of energy, because we can't insert them close enough to the beam, because the beams people are very concerned about. There's a safety window.
Right.
And there's like it's like a Gaussian profile, and it's about 15 sigmas. You have to, that's the safety margin.
You're saying that this process deflects the proton sufficiently that you don't have to worry about this forward.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So to create particles which are of the weak scale mass, the protons will be deflected sufficiently. Yeah, exactly.
So this corresponds to how much fractional energy change, just to have an idea?
It's about 2%. Yeah, it's on the order of a few percent. Yeah, that's when it starts. Yeah, so I'm, of course, very happy to be able to present this. This was published just under 2 years ago, and it was the first time we actually made a physics publication measuring the rate of this process, and there are all sorts of more outreachy things down here. I won't go into much detail because this is sort of along the way to what I'm going to be talking about for the TAUs. But yeah, this is something that I think Atlas was very happy to be able to say. Okay, so these were the three things. So, you know, if you ask me the backstory of how I got into this tau g-2 business, you know, I was watching these really quite remarkable series of physics that was being done sort of in the periphery of the main LHC and Atlas program. And of course, when I started in this field, you know, I was coming from the more BSM searches angle, and I was thinking, you know, haven't we already tested matter-light interactions? You know, what more is there to learn about photon couplings, right? And I hope I've shown you that, you know, we're just making these observations, right? So the papers are just seeing these processes happen for the first time at the LHC. So we're really just scratching the tip of the iceberg. But let me just entertain these questions just for the storytelling of this talk. And we can easily also ask, you know, haven't we already tested back in the 19th century Kepler-Newtonian dynamics very precisely? What more is there to learn about Mercury's orbit? All right, so of course the story here, we can start off with, say, the discovery of Uranus. You know, this was when Herschel discovered this back in the 18th century. People were asking, you know, this is truly remarkable. You know, you've made a new discovery of a planet that we've, the first one we've known about since antiquity. You know, what do? Right? Do you just go on holiday? You celebrate? Well, no, of course not. Right? You make precision measurements of its trajectories, and that's what they did for several decades. And this is when people like Le Verrier started to realize there was something a bit funny with its orbit. So he proposed a new planet and sent the coordinates to the Berlin Observatory, where Galileo and Dereste pointed the telescope to those coordinates, and on the same night discovered Neptune to within 1 degree of the prediction. That's how the story goes. So this was, of course, truly spectacular predictive power, and people also were amazed because they had discovered also a new tool for discovering new planets. And of course, people started looking at the data, and they started to find that Mercury's orbit was also a bit funny and a little bit off. They proposed the planet Vulcan, and of course there was a bit of a wild goose chase, right? They didn't really see the planet Vulcan, or they thought there were some false alarms, but it turns out it was just sunspots. And of course, we all now know the happy ending to the story is that this tiny little deviation was the precursor for a transformation in our understanding of space and time. So I think, you know, I really want to emphasize that precision measurements do revolutionize science, right? The discovering new planets, you know, that's all very glamorous, and people became famous and wealthy because of that in the 19th century. People still do. You can still win Nobel Prizes in exoplanets. But of course, ultimately, it didn't leave the laws unchanged. And it actually was looking at a planet we've known about since antiquity, Mercury, very precisely, that proved transformative, the fact that space-time is not just some static background, it's actually dynamical. And I think that there's a really beautiful analogy that the same also happened with QFT. Right, so of course the electron is the most familiar of the particles, and measuring its precession also, right, not just the Mercury's precession, to per mil precision, that did not discover any new particles, but it arguably led to a much more groundbreaking paradigm shift, to realize that loops are physical, that the vacuum is not just some static background, but a teeming sea of particles and antiparticles popping in and out of existence. And so by looking at the very ordinary, it actually harbored some of the most extraordinary surprises. And of course, people are getting increasingly excited because there is a whole bunch of interesting, precise measurements that are leading to some persistent, widespread, indirect evidence for new physics. Right? I can just take a few of the lepton anomalies that have been very popular in recent years, as well as, of course, dark matter, which I think a lot of people here are much more familiar with. So I won't describe all the pieces of evidence to say that, but just to say that it is across a wide range of different scales. But of course, this is all indirect evidence for new particles. We haven't actually directly seen any of it. So for me, having gone into the LHC world, you know, how am I responding to this? Well, I was thinking, are there any interesting ways we can use all these, you know, photon collisions physics to do interesting BSM searches? And so, you know, there are obviously hot topics in particle physics, right? Or dark matter, these lepton anomalies. And in each of them, there were some critical open problems, which, you know, people usually dismiss as hopeless, right? If I told my advisor, you know, the tau g-2, I want to measure it, you know, they'll say you're wasting your time, right? You can't measure it because tau's decay too quickly. But of course, there could be some interesting solutions from these recent breakthroughs in the experiments, which is why I wrote these two papers with my collaborator Lydia a couple of years ago. So anyway, just to recall, for the sake of completeness, g-2 is a foundational test of QFT. It is talking about the interaction of light and matter. So this g is the proportionality constant in front of the S dot B interaction we all learn in quantum mechanics in undergrad. Dirac predicted this to be 2, that's the tree level term. And Schringer in 1948, of course, revolutionized field theory by computing the one loop interaction, renormalizing the theory. And it is beautifully simple, just alpha, the fine structure constant over pi. It is engraved on his gravestone. And of course, people are interested in this in the 21st century because it could be these little particles running inside the loop, dark matter, muons here. Okay, so the electron g-2 is famed as the triumph of quantum electrodynamics, tested to better than parts per billion. And just to give you a sense, if these error bars were drawn to scale, they would be the width of an atom on this screen, which is just truly astonishing. And of course, the muon g-2, as I alluded to at the beginning of the talk, tested to better than parts per million. Is it hadronic ignorance or harboring of new physics? I think we just have to hold on tight. But regardless of what these tensions may be, I think it is absolutely critical. And I think whenever I talk to people and I point out to them, you know, why don't people talk about the tau g-2? Well, it turns out I think it's this elephant in the room is a bit of an embarrassment for our field of particle physics, right? There is some truly shocking experimental ignorance. So when I was working on this a couple of years ago with my collaborator Lydia, you know, I asked her, you know, do we have any information about the tau g-2? Nobody talks about it. And she went off and she looked at the PDG value and told me it's actually a Delphi result. But in 2004, the LEP experiments, right? And this value in the PDG is minus 0.02 plus or minus 0.02. That is an order of magnitude away from the theoretical prediction, right? And that's like saying my hand is 1 meter plus or minus 1 meter, right? The 10-year-olds I do outreach with can tell me that is a terrible measurement. So this is a pressing problem, but I think what makes it really truly outstanding is that it is not even testing the 70-year-old one-loop prediction that Schringer wrote down in 1948, right? He got the first two significant figures correct, right? Because, you know, this is a universal, right? Schringer didn't know anything about tau. The tau was discovered 30 years after he wrote this down. But of course, QED, this is the leading term, right? It's just describing photons and how it interacts with leptons. QED does not care about the flavor, right? So this is a clearly very pressing problem. And of course, this is not just a pressing problem, this is a very interesting problem, right? When you have a huge uncertainty in precision measurements, that means there's a lot of room for new physics. So there is certainly no model shortage, even before the Fermi Lab result of last year, right? So this is just a random smattering of papers that I pulled even before, when I was giving talks before the Fermilab announcement, right before 2019. Lots and lots of people were writing interesting models that could resolve this. One of the canonical ones, of course, is supersymmetry, right? And this has an interesting property where the G minus 2 scales quadratically with the lepton mass. So that means the tau can potentially be two orders of magnitude more sensitive to new physics than the muon G minus 2. Now, unfortunately, the uncertainty is way larger than what we are able to test right now. But of course, this motivates us making experimental progress as a field. So around the time that there are still some proposals, mostly using lepton colliders, actually, to measure the tau G minus 2, because that's what LEP did all those decades ago. But of course, many of these are future proposals, right? Even the Bell 2 results only just started taking data. And many of these colliders may or may not even be built, right? The FCC, ILC, there are these electron-proton colliders. What we were thinking about was...
Wasn't the last one? Bent crystal. What is bent crystal?
Yeah, so these are very interesting when I had a look at those papers. So this is using tau leptons and firing at these crystals that have very strong magnetic fields so that they can potentially directly measure the precession of the tau in situ before it decays.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So nobody has ever done this. These are some proposals, but I think these are extremely interesting.
You would also need the tau beam.
Yeah, so I think they're getting these from the proton fixed target. So the behind the fixed target, I think they, I'm not entirely sure how they extract the taus from that.
Okay.
But I think, interesting things to think about. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So maybe they're far-fetched or not. I think these bent crystals are deployed at Fermilab and at CERN. I think the accelerator physicists are interested in using them for collimation of the beam. But there could be some interesting applications there. I think they use this to try and measure B-meson magnetic moments as well.
But on the theory side, is there anything better than a factor of 300? You're worse than the G minus 2 by what?
By a couple of orders of magnitude, unfortunately, because it's the electroweak contribution, which is like in the sixth, seventh decimal place. So even two orders of magnitude.
To go more or less.
Yeah.
Better than a factor of 300?
I guess that's a model building question. And I have to admit, I have not seen anything scale better than quadratic. I don't know if there are any exotic models that...
I think this is a good target. Let's not dilute the physics, because this is an excellent target. Let's not dilute the other stuff.
Yeah, and certainly when people were approaching us, when we first proposed this, they were saying, are there anything that scales faster than quadratic? But yes, this is a canonical benchmark. Yeah, so what we thought about was, could we do something better now? You know, I'm an impatient physicist, I'll have to admit, and that's why I like to see things within a couple of years. Could we make any improvements in the next few years without building a whole new collider? So when you actually look at the Delphi paper from 2004, we were intrigued to find this diagram because it was photon collisions, right? So that was what kind of pushed us in that direction, first of all. Of course, these photons are coming from electron beams. So that's how LEP did it. And the cross-section at LEP is about 400 picobands. So that's about 200,000 events in their whole data set. Now, when you go over to the heavy ion case, what's very interesting about this is that the cross-section scales to the power z to the power 4. So z is the proton number. There are 82 protons in lead, and there are two of these factors here. So you square the amplitude, you get z to the 4. So this is a huge cross-section, right? So this is 500,000 nanobarns. That's nearly a millibarn, right? And even with the lower luminosity of the heavy ions, it actually more than compensates, and there is actually about a million events if you just multiply the cross-section by the luminosity per experiment, right? So this is quite remarkable. So this is, again, what pushed us even further in the right direction. And what's even more remarkable is that, you know, when I was chatting with my collaborator, I was just like, have we not even done this at all? And indeed, at the time, this process was not even observed at the LHC. So something a little bit more technical, but just to give you a sense of what I was doing. So this was towards the end of my PhD. I think I was starting to write up or something like that. So this is how you compute the cross-sections for this, right? So the cross-section of this process, all right, there's this integral, and there's this factorized prescription because of the equivalent photon approximation. So this is just following these references up here for the light-by-light scattering. So what you do is, it's a bit like a PDF, right? So if you remember what PDF QCD cross-sections look like. So this is this bit here, this would usually be the PDFs, and this would be the elementary cross-section here. But here, instead, you have the photon flux. And when you follow this prescription here, it turns out you can just use classical field theory, because these are just relativistic moving charges. And you have this lovely formula here for the photon flux, which has the z to the square term, right, and the fine structure constant, and this whole mess here, right? So these k's, they are the modified Bessel functions of the second kind, right? I don't remember what they are. They're in Jackson, chapter 15, section 4. But crucially, it's implemented in Fortran 77. So what I did as a final grad student is I had to sit down and I spent a few days learning Fortran 77. That is what MagGraph is implemented in. And I, crucially, you can Google, right, these special functions, Fortran. That's why physicists still use Fortran, I think, is because there's this whole library of special functions. And I just copied and pasted it into MagGraph. Right? And amazingly, as you will see in a few slides' time, this actually gives quite a good description of the photon flux. But anyway, the modified G minus 2, it turns out there is one effective operator, dimension 6, in the standard model effective field theory that gives you these effects. So that's what it looks like here. Right? So it involves a chiral flip. Right? This is the spin tensor here. And there's the photon there. And it involves a Higgs boson, which is quite interesting. And this is the interference of the standard model bits with the BSM amplitudes. So that's actually what you see here. This is a computed cross-section using this procedure as a function of variations of the G minus 2. You can see as you go to negative values of the magnetic moment, there's destructive interference before it goes back up. Right? So that was actually another bit of validation to make sure that we actually did that correctly. So there's some interesting non-trivial quantum interference going on there, which was quite nice to see.
Which diagrams cancel to get the tip?
It's this first one here, because that's the signed bit. Yeah. Whereas here, the two minus signs would cancel. Yep. So it's this cross term here.
You also have a gigantic number of events. You know, it's ginormous. And beam taps have center mass of energy that is not produced out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not aware. Yeah, I think you raise a good point. I'm not aware of any beam dump experiments.
Well, so you gotta get rid of all the crap that comes out of the beam
dump.
Yeah,
but
here you also have to get rid of all
the crap. No, but it looks like it's a pretty true measurement. Because
he's looking at ultra peripheral, I'm guessing.
Right? Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's not a
beam dump. Anyway, let's see. I'm waiting for the answer. Don't delay the answer.
Compute this without the EPA, or is that never done?
Well, there is another Monte Carlo generator called SuperChic, which takes into account more of these nuclear-nuclear effects, so the hadronic interactions.
It's just the photon virtuality. Like, in principle, we know how to include that.
Mm-hmm.
Has no one done that, or is this always...
So you raise a very good point. And there are, of course, photons inside the protons and neutrons. Yep, and so there is a photon PDF that you can compute, and that, in principle, does contribute a significant rate.
The photon is coherently emitted by the nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
It comes with a virtuality as well. I mean, you lose some... There's a structure to the nucleus, of course, but they exist, these photons.
Sure, yeah. There is a virtuality to them, but we're in that domain, as we discussed a bit earlier, where it is a good approximation.
Or is it always assumed to be real photons?
Well, the treatment of highly virtual photons, people usually use the PDF formalism, the photon PDF formalism,
yeah,
where the photons are much more virtual.
I don't think it's the same thing that I'm... But,
yeah. All right. OK, sounds good. Yep, we can discuss later. So I'm going to move on to the experimental side of this now, because both CMS and Atlas have actually announced their breakthroughs, realizing our idea. So it's been a very nice couple of months. We sent our congratulations to CMS. You know, we had a nice little email exchange with them. They, of course, were very happy. So So CMS got there first, which is a bit ironic because we were the ones who proposed it and are in the Atlas collaboration. But anyway, it's amazing what you can do when there's a bit of competition. Atlas actually also pushes it out extremely quickly. It was quite a hilarious few month or so. But anyway, so this is a really quite amazing, a theorist's dream. So what do these events look like? Yes, so here you have a stunning trident event, right? So one of the taus decaying to a muon, that's the red thing here. So these are the CMS muon chambers. This is the three tracks coming out from the tri-pion decay of the taus. Beautiful events. And you will again see here basically nothing else in the detector, right? So I think for me, as someone in a generation who has only ever studied Hadron Collider events, it is actually amazing to be able to study events that look like a lepton collider, even with heavy ion data, right? Which is just shocking. When you show this to someone and you say it's a heavy ion event display, they won't believe you, right? Unless you put a CMS logo here and you tell them you're actually colliding heavy ions. So the other amazing properties about these is that it takes 1 month to collect a few inverse nanobarn, right? So that's how we were able to get these extremely high rates. There's basically no pileup. It's about per mil, right? So that's four orders of magnitude smaller than the usual PP collisions. And this also means that our trigger thresholds are, unlike any of the other usual 95% of Atlas CMS papers, which have very high thresholds to control the rates, you can actually lower this right down. And these muons are down to about 3 GeV in PT. So that.
If you have pileup, is it millimeter separations as well, like in the proton case?
Yeah, it's similar. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so very, very beautiful. And here are some plots. So CMS, they followed our one muon 3 track proposal, which is the signature that I just showed you, this trident distribution. These are the azimuthal angle, right? So in the transverse plane, how the three tracks that you just saw and how they are separated from the mu, it's about pi, right? So they're basically back to back because there are basically no other particles in the event. And that is their green background prediction. And amazingly, all right, so this is what I was referring to, my Magrath Fortran 77 cross-section calculation. Amazingly, you know, as someone who is not a professional cross-section calculator, we managed to get it bang on with CMS's measurement, which I think when I first saw this, I was like, wow, okay, that's quite impressive that classical formalism actually works. And this is actually the first such cross-section in heavy ion collisions of this tau-tau process. So pretty cool. It is a remarkable process and remarkable result. And amazingly, this is just using 2015 data. This is 0.5 inverse nanobarn that CMS decided to use. And it took, 7 years, right, until we actually made this observation. So the muons, they go down to impressively low PT for Atlas and CMS. After the background subtraction, this is about 77 events here. Okay, so moving on to the Atlas results. So Atlas also sees these beautiful trident events, right? So what's really cool about this event display is that you can even see the pion curl around, right? So these are tracks that go down to 100 MeV in transverse momentum. This is actually a 200 MeV track here. So in usual high pileup collisions, the track PT threshold is 500 MeV. So these events would never make it into the event selection. And in Atlas, we're using muon triggers down to about 4 GeV. So Atlas is a little bit bigger. The calorimeter absorbs a bit more energy in the muons. That's why we have a slightly higher PT threshold than CMS. CMS, of course, is called the compact muon solenoid for a reason. It's designed to look for muons. So again, very, very beautiful event display. Nothing in the events. And in Atlas, so in our Pheno paper proposal, we actually proposed three different categories. And amazingly, we managed to push them into the Atlas analysis. So there is this one muon one track where there's only the single pion decay. So this is the one prong decay of the taus. This has the highest statistics. And the trident event actually has the middling statistics. And there's also the very, very clean one muon one electron. So the S over B, the signal to noise, is much better. But the statistics are much lower, right? Because the branching ratios to electrons and muons are much lower than the pions. But it's amazing, right? There's the electron in yellow, not in yellow, in blue here, right? Depositing a little bit in the calorimeter and the muon in the other direction. And again, nothing else in the event, right? These are truly spectacular events. So some plots. some obligatory plots, right? I haven't shown too many plots here because I wanted to keep it a bit higher level. But yes, we are using muons in ATLAS down to extremely challenging muon transverse momentum thresholds, right? This is down to 4 GeV, and this is after you fit to the data. And again, the signal is white, right? So this is not even background-dominated analyses, right? This is very, very clean events. And these are the signal strengths, right? So that's the observed divided by the expected standard model rate. And what's interesting here is that these are statistics limited, right? So the stat uncertainty in green, right, is dominating the uncertainties here. And we're only using 2018 data here, so 1.44 inverse nanopons. So three times as much as CMS, right? And what's really cool is that we're going to be taking another month of heavy ion data, right? So run three has started, right, a few days ago. And we're going to be we're planning to take more lead data about this amount later this year in November. So very exciting. And just to remind you what the branching ratios are of the taus, this is taken from the PDG, right? So you can see that the single pion is dominant here. And what's interesting about this one track region is that we're actually agnostic, right? We don't do any particle ID identification on this track. So it actually can scoop up some of the electrons and muons that we don't identify because the thresholds are slightly higher.
What's the mu E?
Exactly, it's this process here. So one electron and one muon. Yeah. So the reason why we do the different flavor is because the dominant same flavor background is mu mu. The muons can do some bremsstrahlung and they can turn into electrons. Yeah. Okay, so these are quite groundbreaking results. I think when I tell people in different communities, they're like, wow, you know, this is quite an astonishing result. And the fact that we managed to do this in just a couple of years is quite amazing. And what's even more amazing is that the measurements are competitive with LEP, and they are statistically limited. So that's very exciting. All right, so this is the left-hand side is a bit more technical. It's the likelihood scan as a function of the G minus 2. And this is the expected and the observed. The observed is slightly weaker because there was a mild excess. And that's why you get this funny looking shape. And so you can see this on the right hand side comparing with the existing LEP results, right? So OPAL and L3 are the other LEP experiments. There was also Aleph, but they didn't do this. And they set varying different constraints. The best one was from Delphi, and comparing it to the different channels here, right? So you can see the expected, right, which is when you blind yourself to the data in your fit, is what you should be. Is what is independent of any statistical fluctuations. And you can see it's competitive with Delphi. So that's quite remarkable. And this is statistically limited. So it will improve as we add more data. And yeah, it's just quite remarkable. Right? So the green things are the statistical component. And the total, which is the stat plus systematic, is that little bit there. Yeah, so it's dominated by statistics. Yeah, so that's what makes it quite exciting. And if you're brave, you can even try to use the electron channel as well, right? Which the triggers are not quite as good. The efficiency is not quite as good. But yeah, you can potentially increase this by about 50% or so if you include if you attempt to trigger on the electron instead of this beautiful red line here.
The pi zeros are useless.
So that's another interesting improvement that we can do, because the calorimeter can potentially detect pi zeros. Yep, we haven't done that yet because that is a little bit trickier, and that increases the background noise. But that is a very good suggestion indeed that we hope to be able to use. Yeah, because you can in principle improve the energy reconstruction, right? If you can reconstruct more these particles. Right now, we don't really do anything with the pions. We just leave them there. Yeah. The main systematics, I do have a table in the backup if you want to see the gory details, but it's the modeling of the trigger efficiency is the dominant systematic. That's actually what Delphi also found as well, experimental systematic. Yeah. So that's something we as the experimentalists can do better at. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because sometimes the uncertainties on how we model the triggers And the reconstruction is because we don't have enough statistics in this kind of kinoatic region.
How much more data are you expecting?
So we expect around this much this year. So we can potentially double the LUMI this year. We can also... About route 2, yeah. And if we add other improvements, we can potentially improve it further, yeah.
But ultimately, before, in the high LUMI run,
so the high LUMI, so I think I have a slide about the high LUMI. But yeah, so at this moment, you know, I've shown you these quite nice new results. I think it's appropriate to reflect in the last 10 or so minutes. You know, I think for me, I'm surrounded by my peers who are very excited about BSM searches. And, you know, I can use this as an example to them that, you know, we had a foundational elementary process. Right, two photons turning into two leptons, order millibar cross-section, and we did not observe it until 10 years after the Higgs boson observation. Right, so that's quite, that has, you know, quite a severe implication when you think about the BSM searches, because the deepest scientific tragedy is not if new physics were absent at the weak scale. It's if we were capable of making, right, new physics, but we were the ones incapable of seeing it. Right, and so this whole process of gamma gamma to tau tau and lead lead collisions, the cross sections are huge, millibar cross sections, and we were not interested in this process because many people in the community were thinking, oh, heavy ions, you know, scary. Or in the heavy ion community, when you talk to them, right, they want to probe the quark gluon plasma. You can do that better with jets and muons, right? Taus, they decay too quickly, right? It's useless for probing the QGP, and so that's why these two communities, right, didn't think the other thing was interesting, right? So I think that was the, you know, connecting these two communities, the electroweak BSM with the heavy ion data, that actually was the thing that, it was a sociological bridge that you had to build. And just to make this, you know, this bit of rhetoric and poetry a bit more concrete, you know, I can just show you a plot that I started making when I was a PhD student, right? So Susie has these summary plots. You know, you might wonder who on earth actually makes them. Well, this was one of them that I was the one who made. So this is a Higgsino dark matter search, which was my PhD thesis topic, so I was the one who did this analysis over here. Right, so whenever you see these things, each limit, right, and each paper has a bunch of PhD students and postdocs who work behind it, and I was the one who did this one, right? And you know, if you're outside of collaborations, that's not always clear. So this is the Higgsino searches, right? So this is producing charged genos and neutralinos. This is using high LUMI data. This is updated. Just a couple of months ago. And yeah, so this is the soft lepton analysis. This is the mass splitting of the chargino, the charged state, with the neutralino, the dark matter state. And this is as a function of the charged fermion mass. And what's interesting is the white regions, right? The stuff at around 1 GeV in mass separation, when these decay products are too soft to be reconstructed, we actually barely have any limits. We still barely have any limits above lep.
No. This has been. I was going to ask you about that the moment you.
No, because I remember that, like, we
No, I don't think you can do better because none of the Higgsino searches I've seen, and here I assume you mean the canonical Higgsino where you just have the loop corrections to the mass.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, most of the searches assume that you have some random splitting, so you would have some plot that had Higgsino mass versus, or Higgsino mass of masses and mass splitting, and those would have very large splitting, so you have energetic decay products that you could tap.
Yeah, so that's the soft leptons, yeah.
This thing is actually the lepton. I have never seen anything better than lepton.
Yeah.
Other than monojets, yeah, but I don't think the cross section is too small. We can be constrained, but the cross section of Higgsino is small.
Okay, we can.
Why don't you find it?
We can have a look at that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I kind of, this is extreme.
Yeah, I mean, the point I want to make here, you know, even if the monojet can, you know, discover up to here, or you build an ILC and it can discover half the ILC square root S, you know, whatever, right? There is a lot of empty space here, but I think the point I want to make is that, yes, stuff with you know, modest cross-section, right? This is about 17 picobarns, 2.5 million events today, right? If you just multiply it by the LUMI, and that's per experiment, right? We could have created millions, right? A mega Higgsino factory, and we have no idea, right? That's the point I want to make here, right? That is how ridiculous, right? You know, if you want to, you know, extrapolate this, you know, this heavy ion case, right? And, you know, I think that my point is that creativity and ingenuity is still required, right? And this is why we want to do high LUMI LHC science. So the other interesting thing, which I thought is nice to see, is that...
How can you do? You didn't say. You don't know yet.
We don't know yet. Okay. Yeah, you know, maybe there's a monojet constraint, right? Which maybe you hear, but you know, that's the point I want to make, right? From this, there are interesting gaps, you know, that we yeah, you know, and this as an experimentalist, right? This is quite a critical thing to be able to close.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, that's not the main point of the talk, but you know, you can see CMS have already started to do their kind of phase two high LUMI projections, and even LHCb and ELISE are trying to do tau g minus two as well. So you know, maybe there will be a four experiment combination, which would be quite cool, or maybe very difficult. But you know, just to show you the kind of the updated high LUMI or the schedule of the LHC, right? Usually, when you see this a couple of years ago, 2025 was when we start the shutdown, but we've actually extended the LHC run three by a whole year. All of this is COVID, right? So this whole thing has been delayed by 2 years. We're going to be starting high LUMI at 2029. And these dark green things here are the ions, right? The heavy ions. So it has taken a push by the heavy ion community to motivate heavy ion data taking at high LUMI. That was not a guarantee a couple of years ago. So this is potentially a very nice motivating piece of science for running heavy ions in the high LUMI HC. So that's the point I want to make with this. And as part of this, right, I am now a laboratory experimentalist. And so this is what I look like nowadays. Right, so it's still COVID, so lots of masks. This is me in a clean room inside Cambridge. We're building the silicon tracker upgrade called the ITK. So having lots of fun here. There's my PhD supervisor, Alan Barr, visiting us a couple of months ago. And this is one of the modules of the strips of the inner tracker. So very, very good fun. And yes, we play with glue, right? So we actually have to glue electronics onto the silicon sensor. Right, that is the most reliable way of sticking these things together. I won't have too many slides on bread, but you know, I think we were talking about preaching to the choir at lunch, and so I think it was probably good that I didn't talk too much about this, because I think the choir is right here. Axions, you know, as everyone knows in this room, very, very interesting. The bread collaboration, broadband reflector experiment for axion detection, was on the cover of PRL, so I think everyone in the collaboration was very happy about that, although it was the April Fool's edition, 1st of April. So I think a couple of people were a bit skeptical. What was PRL playing a prank on us? Anyway, you know, I think, you know, we're having a nice discussion about lamppost at lunch. You know, you can think of this as lamppost, but without the dielectric layers, the zero layer limit. This is the electric field simulation of an axion at around 20 gigahertz. Which is quite cool. So I think for me, as a collider physicist, someone who trained from the collider community, you know, I think it's really cool when you can build these sociological bridges, right, between communities that might not otherwise talk. And one of our collaborators was actually from the NASA's Goddard Flight Center. And it was really interesting just to hear him talk about, you know, he doing all these quantum sensors, but from a very different physics and science motivation, right, from astronomy, you know, things like the origins of life and, you know, are planets habitable, very, very interesting. And it's quite fascinating that they are making these precise sensors in order to install in their telescopes, the Origin Space Telescope, which is a far infrared mission that may come online in 10, 20 years. And I think it's, you know, to echo people at Snowmass, you know, think inside, but also outside the box, make connections to other fields. And, you know, not just in this tau g minus two and heavy ion community, right, but also in much more astro particle and quantum interfaces. Anyway, so this was me when I was a postdoc at Chicago last year. So when Fermilab was just opening, in June 2021, I think, this is when this picture was taken. I was visiting this lovely dilution fridge with the graduate student Kristen Doner here. And you can see masks wore off at that time. I think this was just before the Delta variant took off. So very, very cool. This is a nice fridge in the sense that it has a little window that you can take off and install your sensor here. Shine calibration light, right? So this is the tin cans with the diamond windows that you can install on here. Very, very nice. So anyway, to conclude my talk, I thought I would tell you another history of science story in the last few minutes. I want to talk about the neutron magnetic moment, because this is when nature laughed in our 1930s faces. All right, so Chadwick at Cambridge, when he discovered the neutron in the Cavendish lab, actually just a mile from where my office and cleanroom is, Dirac had just written down his equation, right? And people were like, shall we try and measure a magnetic moment of the neutron? And they were like, no, it should be zero. That's what the Dirac equation predicts, because it's a neutral and point-like particle. But when people tried to measure it, they found it was large and just a laugh in our silly human faces. Nature was like, I'm going to make it negative as well, just to confuse everyone, right? So this defied and completely confounded expectation. It was a ridiculous result. People didn't believe the measurements for many years. But of course, we now know the happy ending to the story is that this was the first indirect evidence of a new fundamental force, the strong force, a confining force. Right? This is the only confining force we know in nature at low energies. And of course, nuclear substructure. And I think what's amazing is that, you know, back 90 years ago, you know, people could be saying, you know, why are you trying to measure this, this property? The 15 orders of magnitude away from everyday life scales. And of course, today we now use this precise property to save lives with MRI medical imaging. And so the cliffhanger is that, you know, even though we've solved the large magnetic moment problem, it's QCD, right? This QCD actually opens up a new problem, right? The electric dipole moment. Why do we not see, right? So it's the inverse of the magnetic moment, right? So the expectation is that it should be measurable, but it seems to be close to zero, to very high precision. And of course, the canonical solution is axions. And so to conclude, my last slide, you know, to summarize, you know, I think we must keep looking at nature in ways we've never done before, even if, and I think as the story of the neutron teaches us, especially if it completely defies expectation. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse, for the excellent.
Thanks for your attention.
Questions?
In the compressed region, monitored was in some parts of parameter space. So with 150 now, it's probably the leading constraint.
Right, this is square root of 2. So this is 90 you have there?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not that far. So there is, I found that.
My guess is that it's close to 100 already, with 150. And with, we have to be for above 100.
Mm.
In fact, the projection from Mandel already back in 2014, 2015.
Interesting.
Was that the Xeno was going to record up to like 200?
By the monojets, really?
I found a paper that
really?
40,000% of 150 GeV. There's a paper from.
You say from that low.
I mean, the only one is the one from that low, and depending on the systematics.
Yeah, I don't remember he gave a talk. It wasn't that.
Yeah.
It depends on the systematics. So he has a range, but I'm pretty sure that he's a optimistic range. It's already conservative because you showed the experimental.
Okay.
You're doing the analysis regarding because you actually see the decay in the search. It's not like a hidden.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely motivated. Yeah.
I think it's
interesting.
Okay. So the high Lumi, how much inverse femtopause do you expect to get for the heavy ion collisions?
We expect to get about 10 times as much as we have today. About 20 inverse nanobar. Yeah, so that's running basically every month. Or not every month, once a month every year of running, November. Okay. Yeah, so this is the rate, right? With 1 month, we can get about 2. Yeah. So with a few months.
So for the tau, do you expect, you'll probably see the loop correction, right?
I think that's going to be hard. Yeah, but that's the next decimal place, and that's a very concrete target that I think the community has. Yeah, because we can't even see the Schwinger loop term, and I think that's the first priority, right, to get this down to per mil.
Yeah.
So of course we now got it down to percent precision, and the goal is to get it down to per mil. There are ideas around, you know, like the bent crystals that, you know, could reach there, but you know, this is the first constraint in 2 decades. The first measurement to 5%. We've actually measured G, or G tau, to 5%.
You came after, but you didn't put in the CMS result.
Well, that's an interesting bit of CMS politics, CMS Atlas CERN politics, where we can't cite conference notes in Atlas. We can only cite archive papers.
Oh.
So that's how silly it is. And that's how we managed to get this out on the archive so quickly, because we were having CMS paranoia. Yeah. So in the paper, we don't actually cite CMS as a result. That's how ridiculous it is.
You're legit not citing.
Yeah, and it was a CERN policy. It was agreed by the 4 experiments. Yeah, that you can't cite conference notes.
But if you
it's so silly.
If you put in their results there, does it change much? Does it help?
Not really. No, that's their result. So they use 3 times less data, 0.4 inverse nanobarn, and they only use 1 of the signatures.
Okay.
So they actually analyze a lot smaller data set. Yeah. So they got there first in terms of public results, but we got it on the archive first. It's all very silly, but you know, it might entertain you, you know, if you don't see it.
Phase 2.
Phase 2 is high luminosity LHC.
Oh, phase 2 is high.
Yep, so 13 inverse nanobarn.
Okay, and that will be
So that will be a bit different, but of course this is just extrapolating from their much simpler analysis. They only use the 3-track analysis, which has a lot smaller statistics.
Okay. So it's pretty sure that the result will be delta by probably a factor of a couple.
Yeah, by a factor of a couple. Yep. I think it would be hard to say by a factor of 10.
Right.
Yep. But you know, I think the whole point of this exercise was to tell the community we need to measure tau g minus 2. I personally don't think it will be heavy ions that will make the most precise measurement. It sounds ridiculous as it is. Probably a lepton collider or some other technique. But, you know, it's amazing and it's kind of shocking that heavy ions was the first measurement in 20 years. That's LEP.
Yeah.
And I think is what has captured the attention of the community, which is, I think, what we need.
Have you seen anything on the light by light scattering?
Not myself. No.
But there is a paper out that measures that says that we have observed light by light scattering.
Exactly. Yeah.
How many sigma is that?
It was 8 sigma, the thing that I showed you.
Okay.
So it's very highly. I mean, these are very background free analyses.
Very clean.
Exactly.
Event is just done.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course that's interesting. You know, they set limits on like ALPS as well. Yeah, which is very interesting. And yeah.
But the light by light.
Yeah, light by light is very nice. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Okay.
Thank you so much
for your attention. Thank you so much.